Welcome to Take the Red Pill,
where we explore the realities within our reality.
We are your hosts, Donald
and David. This episode, we are going to be talking about good and evil. Donald, do you want to kind of give us your take on good and evil and what it's all about in your mind?
Well, good is good and evil is evil, and I think we all have an idea of what is good and what is evil. It's very subjective to who you are and where you were raised. If you're raised in a certain place, there are certain things that you'd consider good that maybe other people that were raised in someplace else would consider more evil or whatnot. I remember reading years and years ago that in some, I think, Scandinavian cultures, though I might be off on the culture, giving the evil eye to somebody was very, very bad, like a huge, big no-no. You just don't do it. It was a huge cultural faux pas. Whereas here in America, giving someone the evil eye just says, I'm not happy with you. And it's like, okay, you're not happy with me, so oh well. I think whenever we talk about good and evil or right versus wrong, it just is extremely highly subjective to the culture you're raised in, what you believe, your morality, and your ethics.
What about for you personally? Do you define a good and an evil? Do you have a sense of what is good and evil? And then what do you base each of those things on?
Well, to be honest with you, David, my ideas of what is good and evil has changed over the years. I'm getting closer to the point where I don't necessarily see things as good or bad or good or evil or right or wrong. Well, I can't say right or wrong, but definitely I'm not seeing so much good and evil. I'm seeing more like just, you know, stuff that happens. Whenever you have an experience, people normally label it either good or it was bad. And I'm starting to look at stuff where instead of it being good or bad, which assigns an emotional content from it, which can create an emotional block, I'm trying to see it more as just, oh, this was an experience. Other people might assign good or bad or good or evil to this experience or that experience. I've been focusing much more on how people react to experiences more so than are they good or bad or good or evil. So for me personally, I'd have to say it depends. There are some things that come out that I'm just like, yeah, that's not good. That's just really, really bad. And then there are
okay. So well, I do want to address that. I know what you're saying. From what I understand, you're saying is that there are a lot of things that aren't necessarily inherently good and evil. It's just how we react to them and how we deal with them, and then what we do with those, our perspective on those. But then you just said, you were just talking about there are certain things that you see as bad. And you also said earlier that right and wrong might be a little bit outside that realm. So kind of elaborate on that too.
A definition of good and evil is it's either in our best interest or it's not in our best interest. Right and wrong is more of a ethical, moral statement where it's like that what this person did to this other person was wrong. It was unfair.
Do you think there's a distinction between good and evil versus right and wrong? You think they're two separate things?
I think to a degree, yes. Right and wrong is basically a moral and ethical thing which leads into good and evil. Good and evil aren't necessarily right or wrong, if that makes sense.
To me, I would think that they're synonymous. Good and right and wrong and evil, to me, well, I guess it depends on how you use the definition of wrong, right and wrong. You know, for example, when you see a stoplight and it's red, you continue through it. That is wrong. Mm-hmm. You stop at it. That is right. I'm talking about right behavior versus wrong behavior. To me, that's what's synonymous to good versus evil. That right behavior would be an act of good and wrong behavior would be an act of evil.
So if you go through a red light and you know you're going through a red light and you do it consciously, you're considered evil? That's an evil act?
Well, some might say so. If there's a if there's a child in the street, yes. If you're drinking a Pepsi while you do it, it depends on how you feel about Pepsi.
Yeah. I guess, but well, I'm just going on what you said where going through a red light is wrong, and you see good and evil and right and wrong as being synonymous. I'm just going with that if you go through a red light, then you would be saying you're evil.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I think it needs a little bit more clear semantics. So what I'm trying to do is separate, when I say wrong behavior, I will tie that back to what you said, which is about how it ties into the morality.
Okay.
To me, when you're talking about good and evil, you have to talk about morality. When you're talking about, and right and wrong basically is, in that context, to me, is good and evil, rather than making a right choice legally or a wrong choice legally. Or putting a right answer or a wrong answer on a test. Those aren't morality issues. But when you start to talk about right and wrong versus morality, then I find it indistinguishable from talking about good and evil.
I hadn't even thought of the idea of right and wrong being on a test or whatever, because I was seeing that as totally in the area of interactions with other people. Basically, are you a good person? Or are you an evil person? Are you someone who does things, are you in a right way? Or are you someone who does things in a wrong way? Or are you always in the wrong, or are you always in the right? I totally didn't even see that other level that you were just mentioned. That those were levels.
Well, I think I'm playing with semantics there. Yeah. So I'll admit that. And then it just becomes just a little, you know, flipping through the dictionary and thesaurus kind of game.
Okay, so let's define exactly what we're talking about with good and evil. What is good and what is evil?
Well, that's a really good question. Like you said at the top of the episode, that it is very much based upon social mores and based upon environment, based on how you're raised.
Mm-hmm.
So to really talk about good and evil, there's so much variance in it. It's so subjective. Can we get to a point where there would be a lot of people that you talk to that have different definitions, but then again, there are certain things that people would say are inherently evil, and you would get that almost across the board.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is a good starting place for defining what is good and what is evil.
Yeah, there's always a point where people say, okay, up until this point, it could go any way, and then you cross that one line, that one little step, and then everyone's like, oh, yeah, that's just evil. That's just, oof.
Let's take an example of what someone might consider evil, or what many, many, many people might consider evil.
I would think anything that is done to the detriment of children.
Okay.
I'm not going to go any further into that, because that's actually a topic I feels really odd even mentioning, or really even mentioning. So for me personally, I would say evil is anything that is significantly to the detriment of any child.
So you're talking about like an act of harm towards a child.
Oh yeah, and I'm not talking about, you know, punishing like spanking or sending them to the room or stuff like that. I'm talking about things that you can get arrested for, things that they put you in jail for,
right?
Things that
spiritually, psychically, and physically harmful.
Completely. Oh yes.
Yeah, that can be damaging. Let's say that can cause damage either on a spiritual level, on a physical level, to the point of, you know, severe injury, or even a psychological level.
Oh totally. And so I think that's the first example I can think of where I believe, I kind of hope that most people who, you know, would be listening to this, or even that aren't listening to this in general, would consider that something that it would be not only wrong, but also evil.
Now, let's take that and let's break this down. Okay, why is it that is particularly considered, you would consider that evil, or a lot of people would consider that evil? Let's say harm to a child.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just kind of use a really basic definition here.
Okay.
Harm to an adult isn't necessarily carry the same weight as evil, or may not be considered evil. Why does it differentiate between a child and an adult?
Because adults normally have more freedom. They're able to make more choices. They're more in control of where their life goes and who they interact with, where children are much more innocent and don't have as much control of where their life goes, and also don't really know as much as an adult does, because they haven't lived as long.
What's the difference between a child and an adult then in degrees? In other words, where do you say this is no longer a child? Where do you say this child has experience and has, you know, decision-making capabilities to where this is no longer a child?
You can't do a blanket statement with that, because I have met some really, really street smart and very spiritually adept children that are like 11, 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've also met some late 20s, early 30s, even some 40s, who you talk to them and it's like, your body looks like you're an adult, but talking to your mind and the way that you interact with people sounds like you're in third or fourth grade.
Yeah. So using that example, let's take a 33-year-old person, right? That they're acting kind of like they're 13.
Okay.
And we consider 13 minor. Let's say even 12. Mm-hmm. The act committed against this person would not be considered heinous if they're mentally 12 years old, but if they have a maturity of a 12-year-old, but maybe they have the body of a 33-year-old, mm-hmm. people wouldn't consider that as heinous as they would against a very spiritually well-grounded and kind of ahead of their time 12-year-old, you know, that might kind of have this more mature. And you see what I'm saying?
I totally understand what you're saying. And that's why when you asked me to define when does a child become an adult, it's like you can't really, there's no real way to do that across the board.
Here's my theory on the whole idea with the harming children being categorically evil.
Mm-hmm.
Children are the epitome and the icon and the representation of innocence.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Innocence is not deserving of harm or, you know, of deliberate harm or malintent.
Mm-hmm.
Where adults have lost the epitome of innocence. This is an interesting point in and of itself.
Okay.
There are many, many adults that inflict harm upon children one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
They themselves were children that had harm inflicted upon them.
Oh, yeah.
Now, we say it's awful that this person had this happen to them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Time and time and time and time again, this harm. And then they continue to get older and they continue to get older and they continue to get older. When they're 9, we say, oh, they're the victim.
Mm-hmm.
When they're 29, we say that they're no longer the victim.
Mm-hmm.
When did the shift happen? When did they become an innocent victim to an evil perpetrator? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're so quick to categorize and vilify and, you know, put people in one category or another and dehumanize. And that's a huge one.
Oh, yeah.
We're so quick to dehumanize that we say, you know what? What the people done are evil. Their acts are evil. Therefore, they themselves are evil.
Mm-hmm.
Forgetting that they were at one time these innocent people that were victims of circumstances that where angels fear to tread there, but for the grace of God, all that other stuff you mm-hmm. want to say.
Oh, yeah.
That, you know, had we lived in those circumstances, who are we to say that we wouldn't be the exact same way?
And I think the main difference is children do not have much of a choice in the experiences that they go after. You know, don't know, oh, is this something that is detrimental to my well-being in this community, in this culture? If you're 29, for instance, you have lived enough, you've had a time to make your own choices, and you have a much, much better idea of what is considered acceptable and what's considered more of the normal. And so I think, especially in American culture, we allow you to have more responsibility for your life and your actions. Mm-hmm. Whereas with a child, we don't assign as much responsibility for their life and their actions.
Well, maybe there's a short-sightedness in that. And the reason I say that is because let's take the child here that we talk about that doesn't have the experience and we don't allow them that because they don't have the wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's say that you have a child that's been victimized somehow. And so psychologically, they've all of a sudden kind of had their growth stunted, their maturity stunted at that age that the trauma happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yet we expect them as an adult to have naturally just progressed past the trauma without any help or assistance. And, you know, they've lived in this with this torment in their brains, in their minds, and in their spirit, and their souls. They're damaged. And then we still say, you know what, but now you're an adult, you're responsible. Even though they really have the same growth and maturity, it's ceased at that age. But yet we've expected them to have moved on. A lot of people would have trouble with this, but I'm asking where the fairness is in that, you know.
Oh, I don't think it's fair at all.
But yet we still, as a society, we deem them evil and we place upon them, you know, worthy of great punishment
mm-hmm.
due to the fact that they're stuck and they're trapped. And with that, you know, there are people who have been lucky enough, well, using that word subjectively to you know, you're lucky because you went through all this. No, that's not what I'm saying. Actually, you know, it's funny. I always laugh when people say, you know, this guy, he got in this car accident. He ruptured his spleen. He was bleeding all the thing. You know, he was lucky. I'm like, really? That's what you consider lucky?
Hey, Dave, are you talking about me?
Did you rupture your spleen?
Yeah, I was in a car wreck 13 years ago, and I do not have a spleen.
You're kidding me. I knew you were in a car accident, but I didn't realize you ruptured your spleen.
Oh, yeah. No spleen whatsoever.
Well, you were lucky, Donald.
Actually, to be honest with you, looking back at it from this perspective, I can see where I was lucky.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you why. One of the reasons why I was lucky is going through the experience of the car wreck and physical rehabilitation and everything. Okay, maybe not so lucky with that, but the outcome from that is, you know, since I was a passenger and all this stuff and the person I was with had really good insurance, I had a good chunk of money that came in when I was in my early 20s. This chunk of money that early in my life, I lived on for about 3 years. In those 3 years, I was able to gain skills with doing the whole singer-songwriter thing and even start an independent music label. I was also given the free agency to learn and research and go where my interest led me for a few years in the spiritual and metaphysical realms.
I think you're right. It is very perspective oriented. And I was trying to make humor of my friends have always made the joke about being lucky. And, you know, I don't make that joke as much as I used to, because you're right. It's what you've done with those circumstances. I mean, it could be good luck. It could be bad luck. I mean, that same thing that happened to you could be looked at both ways.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's a matter of a choice. It was an incident without value. It was an incident. And, you know, that's the interesting thing about this is, like we talked about in probably other episodes too, is that, you know, we take so many things so personally. Think about when people are in pain.
Mm-hmm.
People are in pain. Pain is given a value judgment just because we don't like it. If you have a choice of being in pain or not being in pain, you usually choose not. So what we do is we consider pain bad. It's value judgment. There you go. I think the same thing happens with the whole idea of good and evil, you know. Let's use an example.
Okay. No car wrecks, though.
What's that?
No car wreck examples anymore. No, we already used that one.
Sorry about that.
No. It's fine. It's fine. I was surprised. I just thought you were totally like, oh, yeah.
No,
I'm talking about you, Donald.
To use you as the example. I wasn't trying to say, oh, Donald. Step on the room here. I'm going to use you as an example. Lift your arm like this, you know, like they do at those seminars. Well, I'm going to step away from something that's not you, because you didn't kill 6 million people, as far as I know. I'm using Hitler. Hitler is the quintessential example of evil, right?
Yeah.
Because he killed 6 million people. And people say that's an evil man.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, you know, there was a whole country that said, we're not going to really stop this, so do you consider the whole country evil? The country didn't make the deliberate choice, but they were just as complicit in it. And forgive anybody who is of German descent or from Germany. I'm not saying that the German people are responsible, but I'm saying also at the same time, you know, if the German people were absolutely at that time, I really want to make this specific. I don't want to hold anybody accountable now. But at that time, during that period, if the German people found this as completely intolerable, it would not have happened. It just wouldn't have.
Actually, there's a lot more going on than just that, because in one of my psychology classes, I'm sure you probably have heard this term before, groupthink.
Oh, sure.
We actually analyzed Hitler and rise of the SS and, you know, why didn't the rest of the country do anything? It comes down to one of the reasons is because, look, if you were against the SS or the Nazi in Nazi Germany, you were considered just as bad as a Jew. Mm-hmm. Oh, you're against us? Well, we'll just put you with everyone else that we don't like, which is anyone that's a Jew. If you have this sympathy with this people, we will let you hang out with these people and die with these people. Mm-hmm. And so it gets to a point where, even though it was very bad or evil, you know, a lot of people were literally afraid for their lives.
Ah, see, right there. You just pinned the head on the donkey. I play it differently than a lot of people. You nailed it when you talked about fear. And I think that my personal belief is that evil really is more fear-based than anything. And now the people were afraid of their lives. You know, they were able to be controlled by the propaganda because they were already in fear. They're already living in a place of fear because their economy was so depressed.
Oh yeah.
I mean, the country was on the verge of collapse, and so people were extremely fearful. When you use attempt of control toward fear, because that's right in front of them, it's easier to do. And Hitler found a means of doing that. So they were in a place of fear already, and then he used a means of that. And then if people were in disagreement with that, he used fear again, fear for their own lives, you know. My question is that if we have a really solid moral center, we've talked about morality being kind of gray, but if we have a moral center, our own personal convictions, whatever they are, if they're so found and unshakable, can a mob mentality and can groupthink affect us that strongly?
It depends on how big the group is. Because I'm glad you brought this up, David, because this is something I have wondered and thought about for a long time. Coming from, you know, the whole psychic energy dynamics of a person, and from that perspective, I've always wondered, can one individual, in, let's say, a mob of 1,000 people, can they maintain their composure, their ethics, their ideas, their quote-unquote sanity, and not be drawn into this whole mob mentality, this whole group think, or will they just be overwhelmed with this energy and get sucked up into it, literally? My personal experience is, since I haven't actually done tests with this, because, I mean, how would you test that?
Right, exactly. Do you even want to?
Yeah, it's like, okay, we're going to get people really riled up, and we're going to put somebody in the middle and see how long they can last. And yeah, right, that's just, no. For me personally, at this moment, I was trying to figure out, okay, in a mob, what size mob could I actually maintain my sanity? And I was surprised that it's not that many people. From my guess, from my intuition, from my gut feeling, I can probably maintain my sanity and who I am up to about probably 50, maybe 60 people.
I think that's relative, Donald. I really do. I think that the 50 or 60 people, I think it really depends on what the mob is addressing.
Oh, yeah.
And actually, let me put that a little finer. What aspect of yourself the mob is challenging and having you confront?
Yeah.
If there's an aspect of yourself that is not necessarily grounded, that's actually kind of pliable. If you talk to a group of people and you could easily kind of give here, easily give there. Yeah, then it's easy to influence. I think it'd take 3 people tops.
Mm-hmm.
If there is something you know for a fact you will not do, I will not eat a baby, then the mob can be, you know, enormous. You could have a state. You could be in a mob the size of the population of a state, and you're going to stand firm.
Good
you know?
Point.
It's just in my identity. It would destroy my own identity to be able to do that, so I'm willing to have my identity just, sorry, I'll just take the other road, and whatever that means. You know, my identity is so resolute, I'm not going to give it up. And if it means death, that's fine. And there are so many examples of people in history that have died because who they are and what they believed has been so resolute that no matter the size of the mob, they couldn't be deterred.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is the crux right there. And I'm not saying that people are evil because they buy into a mob mentality.
Oh, no.
A mob is more easily to control in fear than it is in love, because its fear is too compelling.
And I have to thank you, because you just basically gave me my answer that I've been thinking about for the past few years.
Oh.
with the whole mob mentality and how well can you hold off. And you said it absolutely perfectly, so I have to thank you. It's kind of interesting because today, I had a friend who basically was passing along a note on Facebook. I read it, and to me, working with energy, I'm hypersensitive to certain tones, certain energy of how things were written and things like that. This felt really, really negative, really off, really, I'm not wrong, but in my opinion, from my view, bad.
Mm-hmm.
It was basically saying how bad this one 24-hour news channel is, and how they're controlling majority of the population in America and all this other thing. Well, I wrote back to my friend and I said, I agree with the sentiment, but I disagree with the tone.
Mm-hmm.
My friend responded and basically said, well, what exactly are you having problems with the tone? What exactly is it? The way that the piece was written was almost verbatim for like a huge high pressure sales tactic. When you walk into, let's take the stereotypical car salesman. You know, you walk in like, so you want a car? You need a car. Oh my God, I can't believe you're driving that car. You really need to get into a new car because that's not safe. And look at the cars we have over here. I mean, just really to the point, nonstop. Mm-hmm. And if anyone's ever been in a high pressure sales meeting where, you know, a friend invited you or whatever, and they try to sell you something that costs like a few hundred or a few thousand dollars, it's kind of along those same lines too. This is what I explained to him. I said, it's trying to get people riled up. It's trying to get people into an anger, to respond out of anger, because if they respond out of anger, then they're much more easy to sway. Then he responded back, and I was like, well, that's not that bad. I mean, other things that we've tried to, people have tried to do with against this 24-hour news station, you know, they've tried to use intelligence. They've tried to use facts. Things like that haven't worked. So now this is the only thing we have left. And I'm like, but the problem is two wrongs don't make a right. And whoever wrote this piece is trying to gain power by manipulating the power of others. Because anytime you're trying to control people out of anger, that's a power issue. And you're trying to gain power through that other people's anger. And to me, that's a negative. And I know for me as a healer, I have to say negative when we're actually talking about something where we have to use the word good or evil or bad or evil. And it's really hard for me to use those terms. When you're talking about something that you feel strongly or passionate about, and this is one of those things that I do feel strongly and passionate about, it took one person to start getting me like, you know, I understand, but, and I started feeling a little more tense, a little more, okay, let's talk through this. If I was in a group face to face with this friend, and maybe even three or four other people that were, you know, constantly saying, but what about this? But what about that? Okay, I can probably see what you're talking about. It probably wouldn't take that many people at all. And I'll be like, okay, fine, you win.
All right, so, but now that's one thing. With evil, we tend to really kind of talk about an act. Uh-huh. So in a group situation, when like, or in this example you're talking about, where you have people that are giving you a point of view, and it may not be a point of view that you own, but you're able to understand where they're coming from.
Oh, I own it. Yeah, in this particular one, I own it. I agree completely with it.
Okay. You agree with the person's point of view.
Yes.
But it was the act. In other words, it wasn't the point of view that troubled you. Mm-hmm. It was the
presentation.
The method. Mm-hmm. In the presentation, because you felt like the person was using anger, which was an act,
mm-hmm.
You know,
yes.
And of course, not to say that using anger is evil,
mm-hmm.
You know, but it is to say that, you know, I think you made an interesting statement when you said it's a matter of controlling people. And I think that we start to see the face of what people consider evil when you start controlling somebody or doing something that completely conflicts with another person's will.
Yeah.
And I think that's when we see the true face of what people define as evil.
We have defined evil as when somebody influences somebody else to go against their better judgment or intelligence or something like that. Would that be correct?
Well, that's a tricky one, because how do you define what is somebody's better judgment? You know what I mean? I mean, and it goes back to what you said at the beginning. It's a societal thing, you know. But and then you've got to ask yourself, what's the basis for a society to consider something taboo or to consider something evil?
Let's take Jeffrey Dahmer.
Okay.
We're talking, we need to go with a specific act, and the act can be defined as either good or evil or bad or whatever.
Serial killers are a great example. They are, you know, almost carte blanche considered evil.
Yeah. Why do we consider them evil? Let's take either Charles Manson or
Charlie,
Jeffrey
Dahmer. Charlie, he asked me to call him.
Okay. David, you have some interesting connections. I'm glad I'm across the country at the
moment. Yeah, I know, right?
Dun, 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 dun.
Moving back soon.
Come to Washington. Meet me. I dare you. Meet me again. But no, let's look at Charlie Manson and Jeffrey Dahmer. If you talk to anyone and say, would you consider these two people evil? A lot of people would say, yeah. Extremely. Now, if you said, which one would you consider, quote unquote, more evil? I would tend to think that a lot of people would consider Charlie Manson more evil than Jeffrey Dahmer, but I don't know exactly why I feel that way. And it's probably something with me personally. It's probably just a visual thing for me, where the pictures I've seen of Charlie Manson and the interviews I've seen him in, his body language and everything, just to me, there is no soul there. Mm-hmm. And if there's no soul, there's no spirit. To me, that person is not a person. That's my personal thing. Whereas Jeffrey Dahmer, when I saw him and everything, I still saw a soul, I still saw a spirit, but there was so little of it there. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I think Jeffrey Dahmer is kind of like Darth Vader. Evil, but it would take an enormous amount of work for him to be rehabilitated and come back to the light side of the Force. Whereas Charles Manson, I don't think there is any hope for him whatsoever to even remotely come close to, quote unquote, getting back to the light side. Mm-hmm. And I think, to me, that contrast with two people that are serial killers, even though everyone would consider them evil and what they did was bad, there's also levels of bad.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of people that would take issue with that, because they say bad is bad is bad, evil is evil is evil, or all sin is equal in God's eyes and all that other stuff. Like, if you take a family member of any of the victims of Manson versus the family member of any of the victims of Dahmer, one would say that to them there's not a degree there. Them, they're just feeling the pain of the loss that was perpetrated by another human being.
Oh yeah.
The other thing too that I found interesting in what you're talking about is when you talked about the soul, or the lack of the soul. They're human being, to me it would seem that they have a soul, and they've just made choices with what to do with the soul in the body. It's kind of interesting to try to figure out why we define that as evil, because if you think about it, I mean, we said that it's a choice against another person, that you know, against another person's will, that's committed against them. Most people would say that when you die, it's not necessarily a choice, depending on how what esoteric level you look at that. You know, you don't really control when you're going to die. So really, on a very logic-based level, what is evil with the idea of taking another person's life if they're going to die at some point anyway? Is it because they didn't choose it, or do they even choose the time of their own death?
That would go back to our past lives and reincarnation episode. I think that was episode 2. I don't want to get too divergent into that area. With the question that you just presented, kind of taking a look at, well, you know, they were killed by a serial killer, we all gonna die anyway, you know, nobody gets out of here alive. Right. You know, what's the big difference? Well, it's what the effect of that life on everybody else, and the contribution that they were able to give to, you know, humanity. Let's look this way. If Albert Einstein was a victim of a serial killer when he was 13, would we have E equals MC squared?
Well, the same question is, what if he had been hit by a driver who was texting, if they had texting at the time? You know, my point is that, okay, intentional versus unintentional, I think, is where we see the evil line drawn. You say it's evil when they have disregard for the life of another person for their own personal gain. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's when we start to see the definition of evil take place. Mm-hmm. People don't have, you know, a choice of their life taken away, but it's not done at the hands of another person deliberately, necessarily, for their own personal pleasure.
Yeah.
You know, war is the deliberate taking of a life of another, but people excuse that because it's for a duty, it's not for pleasure. Mm-hmm. Where, like in Dahmer's case, he was seeking pleasure. In Manson's case, he was seeking pleasure.
Yeah.
And Vlad the Impaler, which to me is one of the extreme examples, he was the big one. You know, this is a guy who had sat and ate dinner while people were wriggling on spikes. You know?
Yeah.
So it's like, and people are like, oh, yeah, that's evil. Yeah, that there is evil, you know. And so to me, it's like, then that's the taboo. It's like, you know what, the evil is considered that when you do an act against somebody, against their own will, for your own personal pleasure. And then I ask this, you know, and this is where ethics get interesting. Uh-huh. What if dinosaurs did that? What if dinosaurs were killing other dinosaurs, not for food, but just to watch them die, and they thought it was funny? You know, and now they're just a bunch, they're just filling our gas tanks as far as that goes. And so in the grand scheme of things, and I'm not trying to...
Oh, I know.
I'm not trying to be dismissive, and I'm not embracing these acts by any means. I do not condone such acts.
Oh, yeah.
But me, I'm just neither, giving food for thought as to where the idea of evil comes from, why this idea of evil is what it is, and why You know, what is that?
I think it has to go back front to when there weren't as many people around and we lived more in small tribes, where if you went out and you killed somebody that's in your tribe, that you're basically killing off a source for, you know, continuing the tribe and increasing the size of the tribe. Increasing the size of the tribe is beneficial because it allows more hunters and or more women that are able to bear children to also increase the size. Where we're at now, where we have just, you know, I think 6.5-7 billion people on the planet right now, it's not as important, but I think that's probably where the idea came from, where it's like anything that is against the survival of the whole is considered bad. And then we brought theosophy and theology and multiple religions in here that took this to a whole nother degree of specifically saying, oh, that's not just bad, that's evil, because evil to me has much more weight than something that's being bad.
Right.
So I think that's probably where it started. It's kind of like going back to what you had just mentioned a minute ago, where, you know, somebody is driving in a residential speed zone and they're texting while they're trying to drive. And let's say they hit a kid and the kid lives, but they still hit them. Now, I think that's more of that would be considered bad, a bad situation. Mm-hmm. The difference between what I was talking about earlier, between a difference between bad and evil, is an evil situation would be somebody driving through the same neighborhood looking to hit children.
Right. Death Race 2000 kind of thing.
Yeah. And you know, one is just bad where, you know, it's just this is an unfortunate event. And then the evil part is what you said, a conscious, specific act of wanting to do it bestowed upon another person. Mm-hmm. Or even not even another person, but another living thing.
The line is more clear cut when you deliberately cause harm to another person for your own enjoyment. That seems to be more clear cut than it does with things that are not human.
Oh, yeah.
Like, people enjoy hunting for the sport of hunting.
Mm-hmm.
They do. It's just there's something in hunting they enjoy. And people don't say they're evil. They're just like, well, you know, if you eat it, then I respect it a little more, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're, you know, hunting humans for the sport of it, then that they would consider that evil,
mm-hmm.
you know, which a lot of the serial killers are considered. They're very predatory in nature.
Mm-hmm.
But what I think is interesting is that the whole idea, I think, of evil, when you talk about some of the more indigenous cultures,
mm-hmm.
they didn't have concepts of good and evil. They just, like what you said, it was about what was good for the people as a whole. You know, there's a lot of cultures where ending another person's life was good for the population as a whole, like in the Aztecs when they had sacrifices.
Oh, yeah.
To them, that was good for the population as a whole. It wasn't for an enjoyment. They just killed people because they were trying to appease their gods.
Sacrifice a virgin to the volcano
sacrifice.
God.
Yeah, because they didn't want everybody in the community to starve because the gods were pissed off. You know?
Oh, yeah.
True evil is the movie Joe's versus the Volcano. Having to make someone sit through that.
Oh, I actually liked that movie.
Did you?
Not the first hour, but I like.
You will never babysit my child.
I like the end. Kid. I like the end a lot.
I just didn't work for me. I didn't think it was bad. It just was like, what? Okay. But the thing I think that happens here is that when we start talking about evil, I think the words evil come with religion and things that try to dictate and use a template for morality.
Mm-hmm.
When you form a morality template, then you start seeing surface the idea of evil. When to me, it's like, you know, we all know going around killing people for enjoyment is not good for the society as a whole. That's a no-brainer.
Oh, yeah.
But then when you have to kind of pigeonhole things and say how evil they are and how debased they are, I think that personally, these acts that we see, you know, that we consider evil are byproducts of a dysfunctional society.
Mm-hmm.
So we, the society, have that within us. If we've given rise to it, those components are in us. And I think that the idea of evil, really, when you start looking at it as a spiritual level and a really a morality level and a greater than just everyday life level, we are all one.
Mm-hmm.
We are all connected. And when you deliberately disconnect, you're deliberately disconnecting from yourself.
Oh, yeah.
As a result, I think it's that kind of harm against the self and the short-sightedness harm against the self by inflicting harm onto others for your own personal enjoyment. To me, it's almost like if I just stood here with a knife and cut pieces of my skin off and just was laughing about it. I'm like, that's just craziness. And to me, evil to me is more just insanity. It's just craziness. It's like you have no idea that the pleasure you're deriving to yourself, you're doing yourself in. And I honestly believe that the people like the serial killers in this world and those who perpetrate such acts, you say they're devoid of the soul. I say they're devoid of the sense of what they really are. And I think they're just kind of lost. They have no connection to that part of themselves that is divine. I think they've lost that connection.
Well, isn't that having a soul? Because if you, well, okay, let me rephrase.
No,
I still
believe they have a soul. I think that they just don't, they no longer acknowledge it. They can no longer see it. I think it's there. I would disagree with them. Great many people who say they don't have a soul. I would say they have a soul, but they just have no connection to it anymore.
Oh, I see. To me, I see as a connection to the soul being the connection to the divine, if not the divine. I see the soul as being divine. And if you're connected to your divine, if you have the divine within you, it's very hard to commit acts consciously because you have some sense of connection with everybody else. It's when that divinity within you becomes so small, so little, so minute, then you're able to consciously take over things and do things against others, such as, you know, be a serial killer.
Well, here's a mind bender for you then.
Okay.
You and I think we both agree that the idea of God is just that everything that makes up everything, that everythingness, everything that could, is, and will possibly exist is God, right?
I wouldn't say it that way, but I see where you're going, so I'll say yes.
Okay. Well, I'm making it really base because, you know, we'll talk about the whole God thing in another episode. Mm-hmm. My personal belief that is that all that is all that is. Mm-hmm. What people call God, I call all that is. I call the universe. I call every possible thing in the universe is all God stuff.
Gotcha.
The serial killers are part of everything. So they are part of the God stuff. They are part of all that is. They are just, it's in them as much as it is in everybody else, which would lend to say that all that is capable of these heinous acts. Would you say that is the case?
I would say yes. I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about what the idea that you're bringing up, but
you will now.
Oh yeah. I have spent time on it. It's been a while. So it's actually kind of cool that you brought it up, and I thank you for that. But I follow a similar belief. Everything that is has to be an expression of the divine. Mm-hmm. And that includes any person that commits an act such as serial killing or on a conscious level. I can't really go much further into that because that's starting to get into the whole God episode issue that we're going to be recording here in a little while. Mm-hmm. I'll say yes, it is part of the divine, it is part of God, which then brings the whole idea of if it is God and God is good, then can it really be all that evil?
Right, and that is the paradox right there. That's the melon scratcher.
Mm-hmm. And I think we'll definitely have to revisit this example when we actually do that podcast.
Well, I will say this. No, I don't want to steal anything away from that podcast, but I'll just kind of use this little kind of seed to plant. The implication here is that I'm being massively blasphemous.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Me too.
Yeah. Yeah, we both are. I mean, because you and I are using different language for the same thing. I mean, I love your expression, the way you describe the divine. I love that.
Oh, thank you.
What I would say is, if we look at it that way, if the divine is seeking to know itself through its own experiences, and the divine has expressed itself in these what would be considered heinous acts, it is an examination for the rest of the divine to see that and put it in direct contrast to say, you know what, that is a great example of the divine not loving itself and realizing itself and actualizing itself. So in other words, our human experience says, you know what, we need to mitigate this particular experience. We need to take this and limit it because it's not a really true, beautiful expression of realization and actualization and creation, which is what the divine is.
So basically, any evil act is basically divine having an off day. Is that what you're saying, David?
Kind of, sort of. I think it's really a stepping stone, really, to, I think it's more of an idea of, it's like, you know what? Can you really know beauty without the contrast of beauty, without what is not beauty, what is ugly? How can you even define beauty without ugliness?
Okay, let's put it this way. You take a kid to Disneyland, and they may have not have seen all this terror and, you know, murder and all this stuff that, you know, because they're still really young. Are you saying that they cannot see the beauty and the joy in Disneyland because they have not known the negative, the ugliness?
Because they don't know the true evil that Disney
is. I wasn't going to go there, David.
I kid. I know there's lots of people love Disney. I know what your point is. It's not that. It's, I mean, you could experience it. That's great. But if you want to look a little deeper into it, here's a great example.
Okay, cool.
This is a silly, silly example, but I love to roast my own coffee. I do it. The coffee that Jackie and I drink is our own roasted coffee.
Oh, wow.
And it's ruined me for coffee everywhere else. I came home and we had a long day and I forgot to roast coffee and we ran out. And it's been months upon months upon months since we've had coffee made at home that we did not roast ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's good. It's very good. It's very delicious. Well, we had some scrap pre-ground coffee, if you want to call it that, in the cupboard, and we made it, and I couldn't drink it, and Jackie couldn't drink it. We so much were looking forward to coffee the next day. Usually I drink my coffee, I'm like, that was so, so, so good, and then I just move on with my day.
Mm-hmm.
But today, it was like I was thinking about tomorrow's coffee.
Oh, wow.
That day. And I mean, that coffee was so good the next day. It was so incredibly good. But I forgot just how good it was. I knew it was good. And I always appreciated it, but I appreciated it that much more because I had swill that day. And I think that sometimes to really see beauty, sometimes there's the contrast because we take things for granted.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know, us people who live in Washington State, as you know, we love the mountain. But how many times if on a summer day when you had 9 beautiful days in a row, the mountain's just there and we're like, oh, okay, it's the mountain. But on cloudy days, you know, we don't see it here in Washington for months at a time because it's overcast constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get one sunny break and we're like, there's the mountain. You know what I mean? You see what I'm saying? And I think sometimes the divine just like, I just want to know just how beautiful the divine is. And sometimes we just need to just take it away. The beauty, so we know how beautiful it is.
With what you're saying, give a contrast as to the opposite of that beauty so that we can, from what it sounds like what you're saying, have a more intense experience with the beauty that is our life anyway.
Right, exactly.
If that's the case, I wonder if there's a biological or genetic or energetic or something reason why it seems like every generation has somebody who is considered really, really evil.
It's funny. I was just thinking about this just before you said it. It's like you read my mind.
I am psychic. You know?
Imagine that. Psychic Donald. This show, what? No. I think the reason that happens is because some days I think you just need to be reminded. And I think because when you take something for granted, that's when you get the reminder. And I think in Western society, we take so, so, so much for granted. We take the beauty of life for granted. We're so busy worrying about this and worrying about that and wanting this and having to have that and constantly in a state of want, constantly a state of desire rather than a state of appreciation.
Oh, yeah.
I think if we were in a state of appreciation, you wouldn't see these acts of evil because we would constantly, every single day, be rejoicing in the beauty that is around us. But because we are so critical, because we'll talk about it very, very soon, because we, you know, sex has become so debased because we refuse to see the beauty in it.
Mm-hmm.
So all sorts of acts of evil based around sex have sprung up.
Oh, yeah.
If we really appreciated and enjoyed sex for what it was and did not see it as this bad thing, you know, if we could show as much sex as we do violence on television, violence, we could show violence all day long, and it's just like, you know what, the kids don't like it, but you know, that's okay.
Yeah.
But sex, we're just like, oh, you know, there's only,
Pokemon, Pokemon, Pokemon.
What? Is that sex or violence?
Well, no. Pokemon, children's cartoons, lots of violence.
Oh, I know what you're saying.
Showing, you know, more intimacy, and it's like, Pokemon.
Right, exactly. You know, but you can't let your children see the intimacy, which is what creates life. But you can let them see the explosions which destroy life. So it's okay to destroy life, not to create it. And we wonder why these acts of evil keep propping up in our society.
Yeah. And there's other societies and other cultures where they don't have such a hang-up on sex as we do.
Absolutely. That is the truth. And they don't have what's considered sexually deviant behavior.
I think it was about a few years ago, I actually saw a sociology report from the amount of acts or murders committed by guns from across the world in a year's span of time. And so within a year, it's like Japan had, 67, and then Germany had 18, and then Canada had 3, and then America had like 20,000, over 20,000. Mm-hmm. I think that goes along with what you're saying, where it's like, we're like, oh, violence, yeah. The amount of TV and movies that we have that does not have some sort of violence in it is very minuscule.
Right.
Compared to the amount of shows and TVs that, say, have sexual intimacy or whatever that would be considered proper. That's denying part of ourselves one aspect and overexposing another part of ourselves. When you break it down into that kind of simplistic terms, I can see why any parent would say, yeah, I'm not going to let my children watch so much TV, or we're going to limit it, or I'm going to put the parental controls on certain channels so that they don't see something, because in a parental view, it is bad for my child at their age to watch certain types of violence.
Yeah, I think that the love of violence and the violence as entertainment is a symptom of our self-loathing, a symptom of ourselves to see the failure of our own beauty. There's so many friends I have on Facebook that I don't really hang around them much because we don't have anything in common. But, you see their posts on Facebook and everything they say is very misanthropic. It's so misanthropic. Uh-huh. It's so, hatred for other people. Other people are bad and this and that and that. They see people as ugly. They see people as the reason their lives are terrible is because other people made these choices that have inconvenienced them and have make things more challenging for them than they need to be.
Oh, yeah.
So as a result, you celebrate that with violence. Well, then, let's laugh at, people getting killed. I always laugh because I look at I don't laugh, but, I watch these shows where, the guy's trying to break into the thing and he's the hero and he just shoots the guy that's on the corner that's protecting the warehouse. And I always play a little story in my mind of the guy who got shot and his grieving widow at his funeral, and his kids being heartbroken. And they're going, oh, my God, I lost my father. And they're grieving for years upon years. And all he was protecting, the plutonium in the warehouse that the Bivalents were going to use to blow up the world,
Oh, yeah.
And I think, but that's a human being. And we ourselves have dehumanized each other and ourselves. That all of a sudden you have these extreme cases of evil, as we call it, rise, and then yet we cast them out, but we just forget that we've created them because of our own dysfunction,
our own lackadaisical connection and observation of our connection with spirit.
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely right, Donald.
I'm just going back from what you said earlier, man. I'm giving you props.
Oh, well, thank you. No, I mean, you've awakened this. I mean, you said it. You said it at the beginning of the episode. It's, the societies build up and create the definition of what we consider evil, which is interesting because the societies themselves create the evil that we've defined as evil.
Oh, yeah. And then since the society created it, they have to figure out a certain way to take care of it. One of my professors in college, years and years ago, used to do stuff. I think he was in Kuwait back in the early 90s. And he said one day he'd gotten there and he had pulled out his wallet to pay the taxi. And he left his wallet on the table, or probably a table somewhere next to it. He said it was about probably an hour or two later where when he realized this and went back to find it, the wallet was sitting right there on the table, right by where he had been dropped off. And it was his wallet, and that all his credit cards and all his money and everything else were still in it, and it blew him away.
Wow.
And now, in the Middle East culture, if you steal something, you know, they will lob your hand off. It's like, you're not going to steal anymore with this hand. Mm-hmm. That's a big deterrent there. Whereas here in America, it's like, oh, finders keepers, losers weepers.
Yeah. And, you know, it's an interesting thing you said that. That analogy made me think of the fact that, you know, we've been talking about what's considered evil is to take something from someone else for your own pleasure. But we always forget that people also consider, like, the evil corporations, which are basically these entities and these people that run these entities. They consider them evil not because they are enjoying misfortune that they're casting upon other people, but that they just don't care. I don't care what corporation it is. Corporations are purely in existence to make a profit and to make money.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm not going to say that they're evil, but I think a lot of people do think they're evil because they take more than they give. Profit is the bottom line. And if they can have an extra $100 or give an extra $100 away to somebody who really needs it, they're going to take the extra $100.
Oh, yeah.
But the funny thing about that is here's what the society, why I think our society is so dysfunctional.
Uh-huh.
There's so many people in this world that shake their fists at the evil corporations and say, how many yachts is too many yachts? How many more millions do you need? But these are the same people that want to buy a lottery ticket. These are the same people that if they have an extra 20 in their pocket, they're like, you know what? No, you know, I want to go to the movies tonight. You know, I don't care if this guy needs some food.
Mm-hmm.
They're just showing on a smaller scale what the corporations are doing on a bigger scale. So I sit there every day and say, you know what? What do I need to do to understand my connectedness with everybody else?
Oh, yeah.
You know, where am I not balancing my needs over everybody else's rather than finding them equal? I think when we all get to that place, this we'll start to see the symptoms disappear and the evil will just won't be there anymore.
Very well said.
Sorry, I got pulpity there for a second.
Don't worry about it. It's our podcast. We're loud.
That's right. We can do this if we want to. So
we can dance if we want to.
So do you the safety dance. That's right.
It's not evil. Trust me. It's not bad, depending on who you talk to.
Yeah, exactly right.
I have to say that is something that I think everybody would love to have happen is just see a continual decrease in bad and quote, end quote, evil acts in the world. And I think once we're able to do that, because I believe we have the capacity to do it, and I'm hoping that for the human race, we will eventually get to that point, that will start to be more of a utopia, a more of a what people would consider more of a heaven on earth type thing.
Yeah.
I'm all for that, trust me.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So with that being said, I would like to thank everybody for listening to us. David and I love recording Take the Red Pill and hope you enjoy listening as much as we do recording. So for DonDalton.com, this is Donald Dalton wishing you a life fantastic.
And this is David Deere. Be good.